What an incredible time to live in a place and at a time when in one moment we can be expressing these like deep cries of angst and of longing for everything to be made right, and yet then in the next breath to be able to voice, God is at work. And we can't necessarily reconcile why he is answering some prayers and why he has answered some already, and what is it about the ones that we have to continue to wait for, but there is this long historical testimony of times like this, where we long for God to act, and where if we have eyes to see, we can see his spirit bringing life and love all around us. Man, this is good. If you have your Bibles, you're going to want them in Ezekiel if you haven't turned there yet. And I want to just start quickly by reminding you a little bit of a story that you've heard, because it's my story and you get to hear me talk about myself a stupid amount of time. So you have heard my journey to becoming a pastor, at least bits and pieces of it here and there. You know that at the heart of that story is God showing up in my life and radically reorienting me. I was a young man, super passionate about politics. As you know me, I'm passionate about anything that I'm involved in, but I was especially invested in my political career. But these political interests weren't about making life better for other people. My political interests were almost entirely rooted in my ambition. I wanted to make a name for myself. I could dream of the name that I was going to make for myself. I wanted to change the world, but not for the world's sake, but for my glory. And then Jesus got a hold of my life and began to reorient me away from myself, away from my dreams, and toward himself and toward his dreams. As we get started with the book of Ezekiel, this is what we see happening with the prophet Ezekiel. God is reorienting Ezekiel's life so that Ezekiel can then turn and help reorient the people of Israel. And this reorientation is going to happen in some of the most basic and fundamental ways that you can imagine. God is going to reorient the way that Israel tells time. Ezekiel needs to learn that he needs to learn that to tell time according to what God is doing in the world, not what Ezekiel hopes to do. God is then going to reorient Ezekiel's understanding of place. Ezekiel needs to unlearn some things about where he lives and about where God can and cannot go. And then God is going to reorient Ezekiel's sense of calling. Ezekiel needs to let go of his personal dreams because God is calling Ezekiel to do something else. Ezekiel's about to have his life reoriented. And if you have ever had your life reoriented, you know that that can be super uncomfortable. And so I think it's worth taking a quick peek at how all this turns out for Ezekiel. Like, how does Ezekiel handle having God come and reorient his life? So flip with me to Ezekiel chapter 3. Verse 14, God has shown up, reorienting Ezekiel's time and place and calling, and then we get this picture of Ezekiel's response. Chapter 3, verse 14, the Spirit lifted me up, Ezekiel says, and took me away, and I went in bitterness in the heat of my spirit, the hand of the Lord being strong upon me. And I came to the exiles at Tel Abib who were dwelling by the Kabar Canal. And I sat where they were dwelling. And I sat there, overwhelmed among them 7 days. I went in bitterness. In the heat of my spirit, I sat there overwhelmed. Doesn't sound like too bad of a response. A little bit reluctant, but maybe disoriented. Ezekiel isn't exactly excited to have God reorienting his life, but you know, after 7 days, he seems to recover from the shock of what God has asked him to do, and he seems okay. Except that's not entirely what the text says. One of the most fascinating things about this book, the book of Ezekiel, is that there is a long history of it with very few other books, Revelation being one of them, but a few others, of commentators and translators not having any idea what to do with it. And coming along and trying to sanitize it, giving it some nicer language, making the prophet seem a bit nicer. The ESV, the translation that I am using here, is guilty of this. The translators keep the language of bitterness, but the Hebrew word for heat, as in heat of the spirit, is actually the word that we translate in all other contexts is wrath. And while overwhelmed, sort of sounds a little bit like somebody who's just exhausted or had just this awe-inspiring experience and just needs to like regather for a minute. The truth is that the Hebrew word here more often means something like appalled. The prophet called by God, the prophet that is going to speak to us throughout this book, had to undergo a serious reorientation. And I thought long about whether to use this word to describe his response, but it's really the best word that I could think of to convey Ezekiel's feelings, his response here. God reorients him, and Ezekiel is pissed about it. Ezekiel's life, his hopes, his expectations are flipped completely upside down. And he is bitter and he is angry about it. Ezekiel has lost the life that he was living for. And he spends 7 days trying to decide whether to get on board. Except even that's not entirely true. He just spends 7 days bitter and angry and appalled. And at the end of 7 days, we're not told that he's done being bitter and angry and appalled, but God shows up anyway and says, it's time. God speaks. And Ezekiel is confronted with his call. Will Ezekiel do the work of a prophet? Will he speak what God has said to him? I wanted to start here in Ezekiel's anger so that you have some sense of what is at stake when God reorients our lives. This morning, we are going to consider what it means for God to reorient our time and our place and our calling. And this isn't just a tweaking of our calendars or a doing a bit more here or there to serve God or his church. This is about a radical reorientation of our lives. And it may not make you angry, but it will likely be really uncomfortable. Time and place and calling. And so we'll just jump in on time. Turn with me to the very first verse of Ezekiel. Chapter 1, verse 1. In the 30th year, in the fourth month, and on the fifth day of the month, I was among the exiles by the Kabar Canal, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the fifth day of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin. The word of the Lord came to Ezekiel, the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the Kabar Canal, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. I don't know what you do when you hear these three verses, but we've spent almost a year in the prophets, and so I actually start to tune them out almost. Right? They feel like just one more cookie cutter intro to a prophetic book. You've read one, you've read them all. We heard it in Jeremiah, and we heard it in Amos and Zephaniah and on and on. But if you listened closely this morning, if you read it this week using the Daily Worship Guide, or actually you didn't read that passage with the Daily Worship Guide, but in your study, there are basically two different intros in these three verses. In one verse, I think some of this will end up being up on here. In one verse, it is the 30th year, the fourth month, the fifth day. In verse 2, it is the fifth year, the fifth day of the month. In verse 1, Ezekiel seeing visions of God. In verse 3, the word of the Lord is coming to Ezekiel. So what? What's going on, and why does it matter? Well, as you read through these three chapters, you'll notice that there are both visions of God and words from the Lord. Chapter 1 is this long vision of creatures and a throne. But then chapter 2 opens with words from the Lord. And all of this is presented as one continuous event, vision and word, what Ezekiel sees and what he hears, so that all of it together is what makes Ezekiel angry for 7 full days. Well, since the first date talks about visions, and the second date talks about words, and both vision and words seem to come to Ezekiel in the same event, there's this strong suggestion that these two dates are just different ways of dating the same day. I hope you're following me on this. It's like when someone asks me how long I've been with Discovery. October is still the 10th month, and this is still the 7th day, and depending on where I start counting, this is always the 10th month and 7th day, but it could be in my 16th year. It could be in my 6th year. For those of you who are in school, some of you tell time based on your age, and sometimes you tell time based on the year in school you are. Some of you tell time by your age, and sometimes you tell time by the number of years you have sober. Right, so in these three verses, we have two ways of telling time. And the text actually tells us the starting point for the second date. And that starting point is the exile of Jehoiachin. And I'm gonna give you a super, super quick history lesson here. Just to sort of remind you, there were two major deportations of people from Judah to Babylon. In 597 BC, Jehoiachin was taken, along with basically all of the rich and all of the powerful people in Babylon, which includes Daniel. 10 years later, in 587 BC, Babylon comes again, and this time they completely destroy Jerusalem and the temple, and they take even more people away from Judah and to Babylon. History lesson over. Ezekiel's book begins right in the middle of these 10 years. I guess based on that picture, right in the middle of these 10 years. Between Jehoiachin's exile and Zedekiah's. It is the fifth year of the exile of Jehoiachin, 5 years away from the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Remember that. This is the second date in verses 1 through 3. But what about that first one, the 30th year? What, 30 years from what? Well, verse 3 tells us that Ezekiel is a priest. And in the scriptures, we have books like Leviticus and Numbers that tell us all about priests. And you can get all sorts of background info. And one bit of background info that you probably need to know about priests from Numbers chapter 4, verse 2, is that a priest starts his service in the sanctuary at 30 years old. Now, we don't know for sure if the fifth day of the fourth month was Ezekiel's actual 30th birthday. But at a minimum, it seems safe to say that at some point during Ezekiel's 30th year, And during the fifth year of his captivity in Babylon, which were the same year, he spent his 30th birthday in exile in Babylon. Ezekiel saw visions of God, and the word of the Lord came to him. These are the two reference points. 30 years since Ezekiel was born, 5 years since the Babylonian captivity, all the same day. But so what, right? Who cares about a couple of ancient dates and which one you might start to count from? But what if it's here because God cares? What if it matters to God how we keep track of our years? See, remember this morning and this passage is all about God reorienting Ezekiel because Ezekiel is oriented to himself. He is marking time by the day that he was born. And we know this. When we count time by the day that we were born, we start to expect certain things at certain ages, right? Maybe some of you in here are hoping for the day, for the certain age, when your parents give you a cell phone. Maybe there's a specific age when you are allowed to date. At 16, you can legally drive. At 18, you can enlist in the military. It becomes really easy for us to declare, I am 21 years old now, and so I deserve ... Right? Or we hit some ages and we start to feel behind. Like we should already have a home by now. Or a career. Or be married. Or have kids. The book of Ezekiel starts out with Ezekiel counting time according to his birth, which means that Ezekiel is intensely aware of what time it is. This is his 30th year. This is when Ezekiel was finally supposed to be able to serve as a priest in the sanctuary. And yet, Ezekiel is far from home. Ezekiel is in Babylon, along with thousands of other political prisoners, the temple nowhere in sight. And we can imagine, right? Ezekiel longing for the day when God lets him, lets his people go back home. In fact, there were prophets that had been running around Babylon announcing that it would happen any day now. That God was going to send them back home. Ezekiel was oriented to himself. If you notice, there's a shift between verses 1 and 2 and 3 in who's speaking. In verse 1, in the 30th year, I saw visions of God. Verse 1 is from Ezekiel's perspective, but verses 2 and 3 are from someone else's. And it's interesting, this will be the very last time in the entire book that Ezekiel ever tells time according to his birth. In chapters 8, chapters 20, chapter 33, and a number of other places, we're going to get more dates scattered all through. And from here on out, the dating is always according not to Ezekiel's birth, but to the exile. Because God is reorienting the way Ezekiel tells time to the things that God is doing in the world. If Ezekiel tells time according to his birthday, he is going to be oriented to a world that just no longer exists. His world, his life is now exile. It's time to start counting time in a new way. God is the one who sent his people into exile. It's time for them to not only accept it, but to start counting time according to what God is doing. I've got a couple questions for you. We're not going to take the time to discuss them right now, but maybe write them down. As you begin to think about a process, what does it mean for God to reorient your sense of time? These will be questions that will help you to process that on your drive home today at lunch. as you live life with each other? What are some of the ways that we tell time? I offered a couple suggestions earlier. How would we tell time if we were counting according to what God is doing? Which brings us to the second way God reorients Ezekiel. God needs the prophet to unlearn what he has learned about his place. I've been thinking lately about the way that Jane and I actually talk about our time in Kansas City. Not so much our overall experience, but really our place there. Many of you know we spent a year and a half there between when I served here as the youth pastor and now. It's really easy for us to describe the neighborhood we lived in ways that make people sort of laugh or sometimes even feel a little bit sorry for us. We lived in a neighborhood where you couldn't have a pizza delivered. There was a triple homicide just a block over from us. And on a semi-regular basis, you could hear gunshots in the middle of the night. The way that we tell the story, it would be easy sometimes, it is easy sometimes for me to forget that we were in a neighborhood with real people, with real pain, real lives. But it's interesting because, like, for us as a place, it was mostly just a quick stop, a minor inconvenience before we were out of there and to wherever God had us in the future. And so, in a real sense, we didn't have a deep or real concern for our neighbors, not in any, like, personal way. And we drove out of our neighborhood for school, for me to go to school, and we drove out of our neighborhood to go to church, and we drove out of our neighborhood for friends and for fun. It's as if we treated our neighborhood in many ways. We would never have said we believed this, but treated it as though our neighborhood was God-forsaken. God wasn't to be found in that place. We went looking for God in other places. And we knew that that place was temporary for us. We didn't know where we would go after Kansas City, but we acted like God was somewhere else waiting for us to arrive in this new and exciting place. And so loving our neighbors was just, it was something that we would do when we arrived at our new home where God was at. And Kansas City wasn't home. And God wasn't there in our neighborhood. Like I said, we would never have said this out loud as though we believed it, but we lived as though this were true. Ezekiel is dealing with similar misunderstandings about his place in Babylon. Ezekiel is a prisoner in one of the most God-forsaken places in the world. The Babylonians were violent and they were super pagan. And Ezekiel and his other priest friends were living in this place that was just contaminated with idolatry, temples and shrines and statues and altars to every imaginable god and all kinds of impurity and immorality. Everything was unclean by Jewish standards. And so as Jewish prophets are running around Babylon announcing that God's going to bring us home soon, Ezekiel and the others are waiting with great hope. God will rise up and he will rescue us from Babylon, from this place like he did when we were in Egypt. And Ezekiel will finally get to serve in the temple of God, the place where God's glory dwells. And that's when Ezekiel has his vision of God. When this talking figure with the likeness of a human sitting on something like a throne, resting on something with the appearance of an expanse held up by four bizarre creatures, is that a decent summary of chapter one, appears. Ezekiel knows who this is sitting on the throne, but there's something fascinating about his words. He can't bring himself to say it. If you look at the end of chapter 1, Ezekiel, chapter 1, this is where Ezekiel describes what he's seeing. He cannot bring himself to describe. He says, the last half of verse 28, such was the appearance of, the likeness of, the glory of the Lord, which was enough to cause him to fall on his face when he heard the voice of the one speaking. I love this. Not just the glory of the Lord, not just the likeness of the glory of the Lord, but the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord, but not the actual glory of the Lord, and certainly not the Lord himself. Why not? Because any 30-year-old trained to be a priest man knows exactly where the glory of the Lord is. The glory of the Lord is not in Babylon. It's in the temple. It's in Jerusalem. And so the best he could hope for is to see something that had the appearance of the likeness of. Absolutely not in this God-forsaken place. Everyone knows that God doesn't hang out in places like Babylon. Everyone knows that, right? The Pharisees during the days of Jesus, they knew that. Why would Jesus eat with sinners and tax collectors? God doesn't dwell among sinners. Duh, everyone knows this. Why would a man who claims to be from God eat with such people? The Pharisees asked. But of course, the land of Babylon wasn't God-forsaken. Sinners have not been abandoned by God. My neighborhood in Kansas City wasn't absent of the presence of God. I just didn't have eyes to see him. No matter whether Ezekiel or the Pharisees or Jane and I acted as though they were. God sees into places that we imagine are God-forsaken. Man, this is good news. God speaks into the places that we think are far too out of his reach. God's hand is upon people in places just like this. God's Spirit can blow through them. But there's more. The end of our passage, chapter 3, verse 22. We hear Ezekiel at the end of this experience, and he says, the hand of the Lord was upon me there, and he said to me, the Lord said to me, arise, go out to the valley, and there I will speak with you. So I arose, and I went into the valley, and behold, the glory of the Lord stood there like the glory that I had seen by the Kabar Canal, and I fell on my face. Love it. Ezekiel gets over the idea that this is just the appearance of the likeness of. This is the glory of the Lord. He gets over the idea that God has abandoned this place and that the best he could hope for is something like an appearance. Now, it is just the glory of the Lord, as though that's something to minimize. It is the glory of the Lord that dwelled in the temple of Jerusalem, the presence of God. But this is what it means, that God's presence is coming near. The presence of God has come near to the Babylonians. God is radically reorienting Ezekiel's understanding of Babylon. The Israelites have not been abandoned in Babylon. But the good news is that God has traveled there with them. Which means Ezekiel's ideas about where God lives and moves are also being radically reoriented. And I think sometimes our ideas about where God might be and where God moves and where God shows up needs to be reoriented. God is not confined to a temple in Jerusalem. God can appear in the places where we are most convinced that he has abandoned. Think about that next time you hear someone say that God has been kicked out of somewhere, wherever that somewhere is. See, because through Ezekiel, God is preparing his people for good news. He's preparing his people for the good news, the radical news, the news that's going to be impossible to believe, that God will not settle for merely sending his glory out to dwell among us. But God himself will take on flesh and dwell with his people, with sinners. That God will come to eat with us and to call us to good work, the good work that he has for us to do in the world. This is good news. We have to be reoriented if we will ever be able to hear it. And I've got a couple questions here under this reorientation of place for you to take with you, for you to think about. And I'm actually just pausing, and I did before and I will again, not only for you to write them down, but for you to begin just thinking about them so that we're not rushing from point to point to point, but so that you have a sort of second to just sit with it. But these are the questions. What are some of the places we treat as God forsaken? I asked our church board this at our last meeting, and it was a great conversation. I told everyone, turn off your theological hat for a second. Like, we're not looking for right answers, but what are the places that we treat? Yeah, when we speak it out loud, we go, oh, I shouldn't say that. No place is God forsaken, but there are places that we treat as God forsaken. And what are they? What would we do if we believed God has us in our neighborhoods for a reason? How might God be reorienting your sense of place, your sense of your place in the world? Which brings us to God's reorientation of Ezekiel's calling. Ezekiel already had a calling. I don't know if you ever feel like this, but like life is all right, and you didn't ask for God to show up and give you something you thought you already had. He was born to be a priest. Hadn't God given him that? But there's something interesting about the calling that Ezekiel was looking forward to. Being a priest in Judah was actually a fairly cush job. Think for a second about the very worst television preachers with their private jets and their mansions, and you will catch a glimpse of Judah's priests. Or think for a second about celebrity pastors with their huge fan following, and you'll get a catch of Judah's priests. Or think about decades of various presidential spiritual advisors, pastors, given access to the halls of power if they will tell the president what he wants to hear. These were the priests in Judah. Rich, often at the expense of the poor. Famous because of their cultural influence, their authority, and powerful because they knew how to manipulate those who were in charge. This is the inheritance that Ezekiel was born into, the inheritance that he was 5 years away from attaining when he went into exile with Jehoiachin. This is the life that Ezekiel longed to return to. And when the glory of the Lord makes an appearance in Babylon, you have to imagine that Ezekiel thinks it's time to pack his bags and to get going. But God didn't come to announce the Israelites' release from captivity. He came to meet with his people in captivity. He came to invite his people to return to him while they live in captivity. He came to reveal their sin to them. He came to warn them about rebellion. And God enlisted Ezekiel to be his spokesperson. And Ezekiel is appalled by this call. See, there is no position of power and prestige waiting for Ezekiel. He thought there was back in his homeland, but there is not one here. There is only the pain and the loneliness and the rejection that comes with being a prophet. In chapter 3, verse 4, we hear this most clearly. The Lord said to me, Son of man, go to the house of Israel. This is the house of Israel living in Babylon around him. And speak with my words to them. For you are not sent to a people of foreign speech and a hard language, but to the house of Israel. You're not sent to many peoples of foreign speech and a hard language whose words you cannot understand. Listen to this. Surely if I sent you to such, right? He's saying, if I sent you to people who can't even speak your language, right? And so who it's impossible for them to understand you, they would listen to you before your own people. But the house of Israel will not be willing to listen to you, for they are not willing to listen to me, because all the house of Israel have a hard forehead and a stubborn heart. Ezekiel is almost identical to Jeremiah in this way. They've both been called to preach messages that are unpopular. But it's interesting to think about the difference between Jeremiah and Ezekiel, right? Where Jeremiah was called from nothing, Ezekiel's being called from everything. Ezekiel doesn't lose all of his training as a priest, but Ezekiel doesn't get to serve in the house of the Lord. In fact, we're told at the end of this chapter, this section, that Ezekiel is basically to lock himself away, not in the house of the Lord, but his own house. He's to do his priestly prophetic work from a small refugee hut. Ezekiel doesn't get to give people exciting news. He doesn't get to run out to the crowds and say, God's sending us home. The false prophets, they're the ones who get all the adoration and the attention for that message. Ezekiel has to be the bearer of bad news. Not only that they're not going home yet, but home is about 5 years away from being completely destroyed. Ezekiel was going to be a priest with power, but God reorients his call. Ezekiel will now be a prophet. And everyone knows what happens to true prophets. This is why Ezekiel is angry. All of his dreams are dissipating as God reorients Ezekiel's calling. But I'm reminded of Jesus, who Philippians 2 tells us was in very nature God, but took the form of a servant in human likeness. And he called young fishermen, and he called them to be fishers of men. And he called tax collectors to come and to be the servants of another kingdom. And he called Saul, who was zealous in his persecution of Jesus, to preach the life-giving gospel of Jesus. Do you see how God continues to reorient in the same way that he is calling us? He's calling us away from lives that we are building for ourselves to labor in building his church. Calling us away from building the world to blessing it. Calling us out of a life of consuming and into a life of serving and giving away. The same God who sent his people into Babylon and then met them there and then called them according to his purposes is the very same God who has sent us into the world and who meets us here and who calls us according to his purposes. Will you be reoriented by him today?